I'm Flavia Bellini Zimmerman from the Australian Club International Affairs in Western Australia, and today we have with us former Deputy Leader of Australia and Ambassador to the US, Kim Beazley, and we are going to be discussing Trump politics in the Indo-Pacific and implications for Australian domestic policy. Thank you for being with us, Kim.
Lovely, Flavia. Thanks for the work you do for the Institute, which is so important to our nation.
Thank you. Kim, can you please explain to us how the recent appointment of former ambassador to the UN, John Bolton, as National Security Advisor might impact American foreign policy?
It could be vast. You know, people are fond of saying about Trump's appointees, you know, whoever it is, as his National Security Advisor or his Chief of Staff or Head of the State Department or whatever. They talk about them being the adults in the room, you know, sort of the managers of a very willful child, basically. Pompeo and Bolton are adults. That's the thing you need to understand. These are guys with an enormously sophisticated understanding of foreign and national security policy, but certain character traits that mean that probably Trump's most difficult instincts are reinforced, not controlled, and given articulation. The first thing I think Bolton is, the problem that Bolton's going to pose, because he likes to eliminate rival sources of advice beneath him and around him. He'll take aim straight at General Mattis to push him out of the strategic discussion and say, this bloke advises you on, you know, the character of your military, that's it. He's not in this discussion that we're going to have on Korea or Iran. I suspect there's a very real chance that appointing him to that position means that in the end, negotiations in Korea will go nowhere. And that it may not even occur. And that, by the way, might also suit Kim Jong-un, because I think he was taken totally aback when Trump accepted the invitation. And I note that the sorts of things he's been saying from his meeting with Xi in Beijing basically are the sort of stuff that they've always said from the outset, which means North Korea's not going to move. And then, of course, it reinforces the fact that the from the American point of view, the Iran agreement's over. And again, all the advice that Tillerson supported the agreement, Mattis supports the agreement, Bolton does not. Now, Bolton has been promising Trump, and what a thing for a president to have to ask the chap this question. But apparently he did. He said to Bolton, you've got to promise me you're not going to start any wars. Now, I think the appointment of Bolton in many ways shows how narrow is the president's understanding of the past developments of American foreign policy. Because Bolton, from the election campaign, if you looked at the election campaign rhetoric of Trump, he's the anti-Trump. He's a neocon. He's an interventionist. He's an architect of the Iraq war. He is a chap who spent a considerable amount of time suppressing dissident intelligence officers, in advising the Bush administration on whether or not a case had been created for them to go to an extreme test. And you've got a fellow in there who fundamentally has an inclination to deliberately undermine every negotiation and set the United States on a course where alliances could split up and conflicts could emerge, and Trump really has no comprehension of any of that. It's probably not where Trump wants to be, actually, though his rhetoric gets him close to there all the time. Allies don't matter, you know, it's America first, etc. Now he's got an intelligent, articulate national security advisor was appointed basically because he's good on TV. And I think it's going to be a pity for us.
Mm. Thank you very much, Mr. Beasley. And Mr. Beasley, can you please explain to us how American posturing in the Indo-Pacific under the Trump administration might change the regional politics?
Look, that is such a complicated question with so many different dimensions to it. You know, the Southeast Asian region, let's operate there, and it applies to a degree in North Asia as well. They're about multilateralism. They love multilateral arrangements. And Obama had pitched perfectly to them with his involvement in both the East Asian Caucus and his involvement, East Asian Summit, they call it, and his involvement with the TPP. Trump didn't trash the first, he actually turned up, but he absolutely trashed the second. And he substituted what used to be the focal point of American power in the zone, but which Obama moved away from. He focused heavily on the military deployment, the military capacity in the region. Started doing, which Obama didn't do, serious and regular patrols, freedom of navigation patrols. And he opened up in North Korea with a determination that they would not have ICBMs, which could well put us all on the verge of war, and which, it's got to be said in the case of North Korea, actual justice and the argument is on Trump's side, is on the American side, is on the rest of the globe's side. But how it's pursued is another matter. So you've got, that is really, I suppose, the what you might call the central difficulty in the central flashpoint in the region now. You move from that to Trump's National Defense Statement, prepared by Mattis, absolutely superb. But it turned on its head Trump's threatening during the campaign and immediately after the character of American alliances in the region, particularly with South Korea and Japan. So the question is, what does it mean? Is it beautifully stated though it is, and very sensible in relation to the intersection point between American power and China? Talked about balancing, didn't talk about containment, didn't talk about dominance, but balancing and building alliances. You wonder if Trump really understood what's handed to him and whether it will survive the attention of Bolton Pompeo once they're actually appointed and start to try to override matters. So you've got this series of events and approaches occurring. And you can now add to that the consequences of the steel tariffs and what might happen with China. And I finish here. Firstly, on the potential of a trade war with China. China is totally and completely in the wrong. You know, if Trump was smart, he would go out and say, I have a one trade position with China, strict reciprocity. Now, if he does strict reciprocity with China, he immediately puts a 20 to 30% tariff on every Chinese good coming into the United States. In IP terms, he demands that the Chinese hand over the IP product associated with their investments in the United States. In terms of Chinese investment in the United States, none of them would be permitted to take a majority share in what emerged. And the company or firm which emerged as a result of that investment. That's what the Chinese do to the Americans, and the Americans have had it. And that's where we start. But at the same time, it's not enough, being right is not all it's cracked up to be. You actually want to get an outcome in which there is a decent global economy emerging at the end of it, And one would have to say that you'd not be confident that that judgment is being exercised by the Trump administration. We won't have a debilitating economic conflict on our hands. Then you've got the steel tariffs. It becomes quite clear as the Americans make their compromises with allies that the steel tariffs are not about China at all. 90% of Chinese steel imports to the United States are already under sanction, put there by Obama. What it's about is Japan, because Japan is a large steel exporter to the US. I don't think Mr. Trump completely understands that the steel exports they do are specialised steels that have no equivalent production in the United States. So it'll become just a big increase in one of the factors of production, cost of one of the factors of production in the US. But it is a clear signal to the Japanese, which is that Trump has said that he does bilateral or multilateral trade agreements, and the only outfit he can do a decent bilateral with a big partner is actually Japan. So he has said to Japan, we are going to damage you unless you agree down and discuss things with us. I could go on because there are so many things happening in the zone, but those are among the biggest of them.
Thank you very much, Mr. Beasley. Thank you very much, Mr. Beasley. And Mr. Beasley, can you please share with us some of your reflections about the upcoming face-to-face meeting of Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un? In your opinion, which are going to be the main opportunities and challenges faced by Trump?
Look, I think a lot of us have had great hope for that. After all, if you're actually going to succeed with your pressure, at some point in time, this comes. Now, whether this is a moment where it's a product of the pressure being successful, you don't know. You would have not. It's a very big card that the Americans have, because Kim Jong-un takes a meeting with the US president as a sign of equality. It's a sign of recognition. It's an enormous American tool. And Trump boasts that no other president could have got this face-to-face gathering, but he did. Well, actually, any of them could have got it. But none of them would have done it with giving that bargaining card away for so little in return, a temporary suspension of North Korean trialing of their weapon systems. So, at the time you thought, well, at least there's movement in a direction which saves us from the possibility of conflict. Because I think Trump certainly has in mind that he's prepared to do it. He's prepared to do this disarmament by war. And I don't know what the casus belli of it would be, but it would be a de facto preemption. I mean, he might give a warning about, testing a missile, something like that, and then it's breached, and then he goes in. That's what that side of the equation would look like. Back to the possibility of negotiations. Two things have occurred in the last couple of days which have diminished considerably my hopes. One is the appointment of Bolton, and and we've already discussed that, really. The second is the first meeting between Kim Jong-un and Xi. And when he did the conferences associated with it, the positions were put out associated with that, it was just back to the old North Korean argy-bargy. Basically, nothing changed, which indicates to me that perhaps Kim Jong-un doesn't care. So, better that no meeting take place than a failed meeting take place. Because if a failed meeting takes place, we have just taken a major step on the road to war.
Thank you very much, Mr. Beasley. And wrapping up our interview, in your opinion, how the Trump administration posturing in the Indo-Pacific is going to have an impact in Australian foreign policy?
Well, it poses challenges for Australian foreign policy, because basically we've got to keep the liberal international agenda alive. Japanese are playing a role in that, but Mr. Abe is really in trouble back home and in his relationship over the steel business with Trump. So Abe has been critically weakened over the last couple of weeks by matters domestic and foreign. But we want to keep that alive. We want to keep the quadrilateral idea in place. It brings the United States into a discussion with three significant powers in the region, of which we're one. We want to keep alive the sort of minilateral, multilateral agenda that works so well in the Southeast Asian region. The second thing is that what it all demonstrates to us, because we're seeing more and more the character of American world power, which we tend not to focus on. The conversation in Australia over the years of, oh yes, well, the US capacity is depleting vis-a-vis other competitors in the zone, the Americans are on the way out. We've had the opportunity now that we sit about and think about North Korea, and as we look at the American deployments in through the island claims that China has made, which the Chinese are totally helpless to actually deal with the American incursions into what they consider illegally their territorial waters. You're actually beginning to see American raw power on display again. And when you look at the proposals that they have to substantially enhance the capabilities of their armed forces with the implementation of new technologies, be they be in hypersonics, in autonomous systems and robotization and so on, cyber and the rest of it. The US is clearly, if the budget holds, is clearly going into a new dimension. And that's the dimension where Australia wants to be. So we on the one hand have to balance our responsibilities to keep alive liberal democratic principles and order. On the other hand, we need to make sure that we can actually defend ourselves. And it's becoming clearer and clearer that there is only one way to do that with 2% of GDP. And that is to acquire and sustain the character of the relationship that we acquire weapons from the states and sustain the character of the relationship that we have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Beasley. Great pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, wonderful. Nice to see you, and congratulations on your program.
Thank you. And for more information, please visit our website, www.internationalaffairs.org.au.